Hello and welcome to a special live stream for Sunday, January 19th. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleagues Ali Abunima, John Elmer, Asa Wynn-Stanley, and Tamara Nassar. After 471 days of Israel's genocide, we can finally say this is day one of the ceasefire. We have an important show for you today. We'll be joined by our contributor Abu Bakr Abed live from Gaza, and we'll analyze the terms of the ceasefire and the next steps as Palestinians in Gaza begin to rebuild and restore after Israel's 15 months of calculated, systematic campaign of destruction. Like many of you, in the past few hours, we've been watching the scenes of celebration across Gaza, the thousands of Palestinians walking step by step back to their homes or in the rubble of their homes in the north and in the south. We've watched the first stage of the captive exchanges. We've seen the heroic civil defense, the paramedics, the doctors, the municipal workers, and the journalists in all their dignity and bravery lift each other up, quite literally, onto the shoulders of their community. And we've seen the fighters of the resistance amongst their people who have endured unimaginable and unrelenting terror at the hands of Israel and the U.S., and who did not surrender, did not concede for 15 months straight. It's been an intense day already, to say the least, and we're all trying to catch our breath and recalibrate ourselves toward processing this brutal Holocaust and anticipating what comes next. People have been celebrating. So let's take a look at some of the scenes and then we'll bring Abu Bakr on.
مخيم جباليا نبث لكم وقف اطلاق النار على مدينة غزة. الحمد لله وقف شلال الدم. طبعا زي ما تشوفون الدمار اللي في مخيم جباليا فيش ولا دار واقفة. وبنقول لكم بدنا نعمرها وترجع احلى من قبل. واهم حاجة انه انتصرنا انتصار. وهينا رجعنا خيوة على مخيم جباليا والوضع عايز كوفة غصبا عن الكل وهينا في مخيم جباليا وعاشت المقاومة.
تروح على الشمال واعمل بيت من اول وجديد وان شاء الله خاوه نعمر غزه خاوه نعمر غزه
Let's begin with how we're thinking about all of this. Ali, why don't you set us up and then we'll bring Abu Bakr in.
Well, I've been up since early in the morning here in Amman, and it's now just past midnight, and it's been all so much to take in. I mean, the most important thing is that people in Gaza are getting relief from the bombing, from the savagery, from the constant flow of blood, and a chance to catch their breath. And it's just been unbelievable. I mean, many of us, I think, have cried tears of joy today for the first time after crying tears of sadness for more than a year. And although there is so much loss, so much death, so many loved ones that people have lost, there is something to celebrate today. It's not a small thing. And so people's emotions are mixed. Everything is in there. And I just want to hear from Abu Bakr, really. I think he's the one who can set it up for us.
Let's bring him in. Abu Bakr, are you there? Oh, there you are. Hi.
How are you?
I don't even know what question, you know, we should ask you first. Tell us what this day has brought for you, what you've seen, what it has meant for you. You survived. And we're all so grateful and so proud of you.
Thank you so much. I think first we need to lower our voices a little because everyone around me is asleep.
That's for the first time in 15 months. Yes.
Yeah.
Peaceful sleep.
It's just 11 p.m. here around midnight. But yes, just we need to lower our voices. I think it's been, wow. I mean, I never expected that to be real at all. Just when you see even like the hospital, another shape, another look inside it, everyone is happy. Just a few days ago, a day before the ceasefire, the hospital was reflecting a deeply traumatic picture where mothers were ululating over the bodies of their loved ones and children, and fathers were screaming in pain after losing their children and their loved ones. And corpses were being taken outside and inside the hospital. Now, what I've seen today is just people are happy, so happy, jubilant, and they're showing extreme passion, amazing, unprecedented passion, a love of life. The steadfastness they've been showing, the resilience every time and every single day. It's been literally, literally amazing and fascinating. And if we talk about children in more details, the children, this is the first time they're playing outside. This is the first time they are gathering with their families. This is the first time they have snacks in their hands that they can enjoy. This is the first time they are playing football together in the streets. This is the first time they are really dancing, they're really chanting, and the wails are replaced by honks, the wails are replaced by cheers. This is literally an unprecedented time. This is something we've never seen, we haven't seen over the course of this genocide. It's been 470 days. And let me just tell you, personally speaking, I'm really happy. Like I always said it, and I was always hopeful, particularly you, Nora and Ellie, and I said it, that we would do that live stream in a time of no hostilities. And now here we are. I mean, it's day one of the Gaza ceasefire. It's not day 471. It's one only. So the hope that I always clung onto, the feelings of joy, happiness, and that smile, I will never lose it, as I promised you. I really remember just probably 2 months ago when we did about the starvation, we did a live stream about the starvation, you were really affected. I told you that, no, I'm here, he's smiling, I'm here with you. So amazing. I'm really proud too, and really happy to be with such an amazing team. And again, I'll say it in the live stream, we need Tamara to be on, okay?
We'll try to convince her. We'll try to convince her for you.
I told her many times the WhatsApp, but she's not responding. She's quite, you know, shying away from that. I don't know why.
Well, today you are rightly the star of the show, and people of Gaza are the star of the show. And Abu Bakr, you have, over the last few days, over the last 15 months, you have been doing incredible journalism while trying to survive this genocide, while trying to care for your family, while dealing with the health issues that come with being forced to live under such a horrific situation. And, you know, today is a day of joy and happiness and celebration. What do you think? I mean, maybe we should just stop there and focus on that. But I think there is a question many people have about what comes next in the future. Have you thought about that? Are people around you talking about that? What's the feeling in Gaza?
I really don't want to share more heartbreaks, but the reality is that most people here trapped in the territory are saying that the first thing they want to do is just go back to their houses and inspect what has happened there, because what we've seen, particularly in the northern parts of central Gaza, in El Baraj and Al-Zayrat, and also in the southern part of the Strip, at Khan Yunis and Rafah, specifically the eastern outskirts, people are getting back to absolutely nothing, like literally nothing. There is just a massive scale of destruction. There's nothing to really build on at all. And the streets reflect a very, very, very miserable picture that cannot be imagined at all. But what is more heartbreaking is that a lot of families here say that they haven't buried their loved ones, they haven't buried their children, they haven't buried their brothers, their sisters. And a lot of people whom I've been talking to say, I don't know if my loved one, brother, neighbor, or friend, or colleague is still alive or not. A lot of people have been missing during this time. A lot of people's corpses have been bulldozed and taken elsewhere. So I know that there will be more atrocities unfolding across Gaza, because this is not the end of atrocities unfolding in terms of the bombings, in terms of what Israel is unleashing in Gaza. But the reality is that today we've been informed by some of those who were going back to their houses, there were injuries among people because the places were full of explosives after the Israeli war withdrawal. And this is something very alarming for people, particularly for those who are getting back to their houses and to their sound houses. So there is still so much work for the municipalities here to do in terms of making sure that people will not be harmed if they go back to their houses after the Israeli troops withdrawal from the active war zones before the ceasefire. And just it's deeply concerning that the first thing people would do is just to go back to their houses and retrieve the bodies of their loved ones and take them to the graveyard. This is absolutely unimaginable. It's insurmountable, of course, but I think that it's still that people are resilient. People are very, very hopeful of a good future in Gaza. They want to rebuild together. They're sticking together. And that feeling of unity, that feeling of togetherness is really shining through Gaza one more time again. And that's what people have been always craving and crying for. So it's their time to decide what their future is going to be like. It's their time to determine what they want to do in the future and to do all that kind of rebuilding and all that kind of, you know, refreshing their lost lives that have been absolutely stolen by the Israeli regime, let me say.
Boubacar, can you describe for us what it sounds like now in Gaza without the constant buzzing of drones, what you've noticed that has changed since yesterday? Take us to Gaza. Take us to what it looks like, to what it smells like, to what it sounds like.
I'm really sorry to say, but Israeli drones are buzzing in the sky right now, sporadically, not very regularly as before. There is still a very clear sound of the buzzing in the sky. But what Gaza looks like right now is that I don't see fears among people going to their sleep at all. My entire family is sleeping right now. They don't care about what will happen in those hours. And it's just like, it's a feeling of safety, security that we've been deprived of since the start of this war. This is something, I mean, my mother and my father today in the family, they're free from the terror they have been through. They're free from the mental torture they have been through. Today, for the very first time I have, when I went walking the streets, I really felt that much tranquility, that much really freedom inside myself, that I'm no longer afraid of being targeted, of being bombed, and that there's a ceasefire in Gaza. There are no more hostilities. There's a very, very Wow, it's a wonderful ambience that people, there is a lot of activity in the streets, traffic in the streets, something we've never seen since this war really broke out, and just people joy, people distributing sweets to each other, mothers crying for the first time in happiness and elation, not in pain. And just as I said, children playing outside, dancing, and people backing up, removing those flimsy, leaky, damp and frigid tents. They are no longer there. Those displacement camps, once always drawing horror for people, drawing so much suffering, deep anguish in their hearts, are no longer there. They've been removed. And just people don't want even to take those tents with themselves. They just say, we don't want anything that can really remind us of this Holocaust. That's why when I said on Twitter that I'm a Holocaust survivor, the Zionists, let me say, didn't like it. I've just read some of the replies. They were absolutely disgusting, but it's okay. It's a Holocaust in the end. But yeah, people know that they cannot really believe that they have survived it. They cannot really believe that they have made it. A lot of people, you need to remind people that the devastation needs to be crystallized for everyone around the world. But yet, I know Nakba survivors who are still alive. I know a lot of people who are still alive. But we know that there are many children who were born in the war and killed during it. There are many children who were stripped of their humanity. There were a lot of amputations, a full generation, co-authored by the U.S. Israeli genocide now in Gaza. Those scenes will haunt us in the next few days. And the losses that we still cannot really realize that they happened, particularly for me, when you talk about my dearest friend, my aunt's family, who was wiped out, I still cannot really comprehend it. It's quite inconceivable. But yes, of course, like, we need to rise from the ashes again, because that's the spirit of the Palestinian people. And particularly for me, I just wanted to emerge from that deadly attack and aggression on Gaza with hope, and I never lost it. I will never lose it. And just again, this is just the first step until the liberation is inevitable.
Well, Becky, I'm just so happy to see you. We can't compare ourselves to those who are in Gaza and the worry they have. But for the first time tomorrow, I'll wake up in the morning without checking. Well, I'll still check my WhatsApp, but without that sense of looking to see who's there, look for those replies and look for those tweets that give us a sense of relief to know that those we love in Gaza are still there, still alive. And and that's a fear that people in Gaza have had for each other all this time. And I think especially if people outside, you know, people from Gaza who are outside Gaza, separated from their families and worried about their families in Gaza. And it's just such a relief not to have that. And I know that there are still so many difficulties, the destruction of the infrastructure, the massive destruction of housing, all those challenges are real. But if this deal is adhered to and followed, then 600 to 700 trucks will be entering Gaza every day, which is supposedly more than before the war. The first trucks supposedly entered today. Have you seen any difference in terms of the situation, or is that still too early?
No, there have been no trucks allowed so far in Gaza. But there have been promises stated that the humanitarian situation will improve in the next few days. I think trucks will start getting into Gaza in the next few days. Also, building companies, particularly Egyptian ones, will enter Gaza to help clear the rubble of houses. And the first thing that will be guaranteed to get into Gaza in terms of the aid is medical aid and supplies, and the international convoys that will help doctors, treat Palestinians, those who have been wounded during the genocide and sustained life-changing injuries. And but there is very seen a noticeable it's a better humanitarian situation. Prices have declined and people can really afford right now, but aid hasn't been allowed to enter. But I think in the next few days people will be much more relieved by the surge of aid and the flows of aid getting into Gaza. But let me say one thing. I do believe that there must be an attack on humanitarian organizations. As I always said it, they are the second reason why we've been suffering all that time. They're not honest. They're not transparent. They're not good at all. They're just feeding upon our suffering. This is something I'm trying to tell people about. This is something I'm trying to tell the outside world, not to help those organizations fulfill their hidden plans, their hidden intentions. And people have to be aware of that, because all those humanitarian organizations will be masquerading as humanitarian in the next few days and just making and setting up organizations and different plans in Gaza to try and convince the world, in fact, can deceive them and just to say that we are helping people in Gaza. But this will not be feasible, because we cannot really be fooled at the moment. Every Gaza knows that humanitarian organizations play a major role in really, really large and really, really worsening the situation and just like dehumanizing people. And this is something really very, very disheartening. So I don't know what the best solution is, but I believe UNRWA has been really, really critical in helping Palestinians. Other than UNRWA, a few humanitarian organizations can be trusted. There are many disgraceful stories that I'm aware of, particularly from what's in the kitchen, from the WFP, from Manira, from Rahma, and other organizations. I've been talking to many people there, and what I know is that every humanitarian organization was getting aid into Gaza, was getting goods as aid into Gaza, and earning around $1 million a day in Gaza. So yeah, I'm really aware of that. A lot of merchants and officials from the National Ministry of Economy in Gaza told me that they are earning $1 million a day in Gaza. This is during the time of the genocide. So feeding upon our suffering is intolerable. People have to know that. People have to know that it's not only the Israelis, it's also those who were complicit in the genocide, those who justified our killing, particularly the Western media, the Western mainstream media, those who masqueraded and pretended to be human but came to feed upon our suffering, those who never thought the Palestinians deserve to be human, those who really deemed us as subhumans. So all those people are also unforgivable, and I hope that they are going to be held accountable for the crimes. They are really crimes they have been committing against people. So I believe that they are as evil as the regime.
Abu Bakr, we should probably let you go and sleep because it's late.
No.
Hey. People are asking though about your yellow rose and how it has grown.
Yeah, I still have a lot of it. Like, yeah, because I think it's now winter. Yellow roses here in Palestine do not grow in winter, fortunately. But yeah, still, and even the jasmine trees, let me say, the jasmine trees are still there, but there are no flowers at the moment. It's a different weather here in Gaza. I still have that, that basil. I still have that jasmine tree. I still have that, of course, yellow rose. I still have that garden blooming. I showed Dr. Ali the lemon tree and the garden. And yes, we're still so much connected with the land and with what we are growing, with the fruits and everything that we really, really planted and built during this time. And we need really to consolidate that, of course, because this is this is our mentality for sure, and this is what we've been instilled into. Just the hope and the spirit and the essence of the Palestinian community, the social fabric has always been targeted by the Israelis, but it has never been weakened at all. We are going to strengthen it, and we are going to build on it and just, you know, move away with that source of hope, that source of happiness, and that source of resilience until, again, as I say, that we're not totally happy with the ceasefire, because this is just Gaza. People have to be aware and conscious of and about the reality, the harsh reality of living inside Gaza, even before October the 7th. This is something people have to be aware of. We're still occupied, we're still subjugated, we're still suffocated inside Gaza. So we're working hard. The free people of the world should not really forget what Zionism has done to us and what Israel has done to us. It's really unforgivable. And I don't think peace is feasible at the moment, because Israel has killed every attempt to peace. So this is very, very impossible to achieve at the moment, and maybe in the next years. Israel has just created a full generation desperate for retaliation. So this is what Israel has to expect. And this is what will be unfolding in the next few, in the next few years. So I know it's not the end of the story, the end of the conflict, but it will continue until every Palestinian literally feels free. Because again, I can't really go to Jerusalem. I can't really go to my hometown, which is Beit Daras.
Oh no.
Ugh. The infrastructure is still so fragile, of course.
Yeah.
devices. We'll get him back in a couple of minutes. But I think what Abu Bakr is saying is so important, that, I mean, today we're focusing on the joy and the relief and the celebrations, and quite rightly so. But the scale of the catastrophe in Gaza is enormous, but also the scale of the hope and the determination and the motivation. I mean, what was so incredible today was seeing the Gaza municipality immediately announce that it's getting to work, reopening roads, starting to restore services. The traffic police came out immediately. I've been watching all day with footage coming from every part of Gaza all day. There are no signs of disorder. People are, you know, the police are back in the streets. Everything, the government is still there. And that's critical, because remember all this talk we've been hearing over the past 15 months about the day after, as if the government of Gaza was going to just be erased, right? And then they were going to be able to impose whatever they wanted, or Jared Kushner was going to be able to come in and start building his condos. The government of Gaza operated throughout this genocide, and it immediately came back out and was immediately visible right away. That's incredible. I think Abu Bakr is back.
He can come. He is.
Yeah.
Abu Bakr. Are you there? Hi.
So yeah, so what I was talking about is just like, as I said, we don't need to be fooled by the ceasefire deal. It's a fragile. It's not what Palestinians have been always desperate for and looking for, because I'm still a refugee in Deir al-Balah. A lot of people are still refugees in Deir al-Balah. Dr. Ali has been away for a very long time and he cannot really see his hometown. We hold the same story. We hold the same agony. We have carried it since 1948 when Israel colonized the occupied Palestinian territories and occupied them. This must be really, really on the mind of everyone. This must be in the heart of everyone. And this is something we will always be working towards until we make it very, very real and make it, and that a dream is just coming true.
We are so proud of you. And, you know, I think we all wish the world for you and your family and your community. And, you know, this is part of this long struggle toward liberation. And, you know, you have made us stronger. And you've proved, I think, to the world what bravery and courage and steadfastness means. And we're so grateful. I don't think we can ever repay, you know, the debt that we owe to you for the work that you've done and the words that you've spoken to us and to our audience. Everyone is so grateful, Abu Bakr.
We look forward to your yellow rose blooming again in the spring.
And to your football reporting. I cannot wait for you to go back to, you know, what you love to do.
We might have to introduce a regular sports report on
the live stream.
I don't know. Maybe that's Yeah, that's something, because everything I know about sports in Palestine, I learned from you, Abu Bakr. And there are so many stories to tell, particularly of the athletes that you have been following for so many years, and so many of whom have also been become disabled in this war or lost their lives. And you're absolutely passionate about them, and you're passionate about sports. And it's something that we all want you to be able to focus on instead of war reporting. Seeing you take that vest off today and take your helmet off was really a wonderful moment, and we will be seeing a lot more of you, Abu Bakr, but today we just want to say thank you and congratulations. Alhamdulillah, asalamtak, and to you, your family, and your community. We love you so much, Abu Bakr, and we can't wait to see you in person.
Of course, that is
somewhere, somehow soon.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. That's going to be, inshallah, very, very imminent. And when I say, because I've seen some of the journalists speaking about the electronic intifada, is not a compliment. It's really, really the truth. You've been absolutely without a doubt for me. And I'm talking here. And if other media outlets that I work with will be sad about it, okay, let them be sad about it. But that has covered the genocide with the best platform. Really, that has platformed for Palestinian trapped in the territory. You have given it everything. Nora, Ali, Tamara, Asa, John, everyone on the team, David, Omar, all of you really, really must be eulogized, must be praised so much. And if we share one thing today, if we really want to share one thing today, it's you. You've been all through that journey with us. You've been all through that journey of suffering, all that journey of pain with us all the time. That means so much. That really strengthened our mentality, our spirit to continue enduring what was unfolding and what was happening to us every single hour and every single moment. So thank you so much for your work, for everything you've been doing. It's an honor that anyone watches you. It's an honor that anyone works with you. It's an honor that anyone knows you and knows your great work. So from here, from where I've been, it's been one of the most beautiful things, if not the most beautiful thing during this world that I've known. Such an incredibly, incredibly out of the world team that I'm speaking to right now. So I'm so grateful. My family is so grateful. And as just 22 years old, I think 2021, that is going to be 10. 10 is going to be it's my favorite number. And this number must be just put up there on the electronic intifada. And just a couple of things before I leave. We talked about something, the email address. That is something that I need to take. The second thing is the second thing is going to be that we're going to be together and enjoying that everyone has to invite me to an okra plate. That is something I've been deprived of. So bear in mind that this is going to be very feasible. And again, we're going to see you for sure. I'm so thankful. I'm so grateful. I don't have the words, to be honest, to tell you how grateful I am to be a part of you, to get to know you. My family knows you maybe more than they know me right now. I mean, it's incredible. Thank you so much.
You're waiting for Bamia. Meanwhile, I can't wait until we can split a pizza. You've been sending me pictures of the food that you want to make. And I know that we're going to have a pizza party at some point.
Yeah. I can cook better than most of the women of the world. That's what I can say.
I'm sure. Oh, yeah. Thank you so much, Abu Bakr. Please get some sleep.
Get some sleep, Abu Bakr, and I promise not to text you early in the morning.
But the delay in the sleep is very, very much worth it. There's no better end for the day and to this day. And to this very, very historic day, being those people. And tomorrow should have been on. It's, I mean.
We'll work on her. We'll work on that for a future time. We'll see you many, many times.
You should really find her after it.
Red card tomorrow. Thank you, Abu Bakr. Please get some sleep.
We'll great work, soon. Abu Bakr.
Yeah.
Good night. Yeah. God bless you.
Thanks.
Amazing.
He's done some great work.
He's just tenacity. Unbelievable. Amazing.
Stop worrying about him.
Yeah. 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 Oh, well, thank you for sticking with us through that. It was pretty emotional, I think, for all of us. And I saw in the chat that our audience was also really happy and emotional seeing Abu Bakr smile. And let's talk about the terms of the ceasefire, what we know, what comes next, really.
Well, I mean, it's a very important day, obviously. And I think the most important thing is that Palestinians didn't surrender. Nobody in Gaza surrendered. The terms of the deal are the same terms of the deal. Abu Obeidah said it today in his speech. The Qatari prime minister said it, that this is the same deal as November and December of last year. We're looking at the humanitarian stage of that agreement that could have been done in November of 2023, but that wasn't what Israel wanted. Israel didn't want to return their people. They wanted to destroy Gaza. They wanted to destroy the government of Gaza, which Ali said failed. They wanted to destroy the Qassam brigades, which clearly failed. And so those terms that for all the suffering and all of the catastrophe of this last year, none of that violence made Palestinians concede on any point of the deal. So the first stage of the deal goes into effect today. The first 7 days of the deal, the Israeli military is withdrawing from the western edge of the Netzarim corridor. By the end of the seventh day, they will be off the coastal road. 7 days from today, Palestinians will be able to return to the north. The 1.8 million that were forced out, or 1.8 million that are in the south, many of whom are from the north, will be able to return, and they will be able to show scenes. I mean, we showed some of that B-roll while we were opening the show. But remembering back to the death march, the virtual death march that Israel put people on to walk down to the south, that is going to be returned. People are going to be walking to the north, back to their homes. And that's the first thing that everybody wants, to reunite with their families. And that will happen after 7 days. The agreement is to return in the first phase 2,000 prisoners. 1,200 of those are Gaza bargaining chips. Those are people that were taken from Gaza with no charges. We watched them get frog marched out of shelters. We watched medical workers get frog marched out of hospitals. None of those people have charges. They went into torture camps in the south. We know about those camps and the brutality that went along with them. Those people were bargaining chips, and all of those people will be returning back to Gaza in this first 42 days, phase one of this agreement. As well, there'll be 735 security prisoners, Israel calls them, political prisoners, resistance prisoners, that will be released. And it's interesting to note, this is a Qassam operation. But the breakdown of the prisoners is unified. Abu Ubaidah talked about all of the factions as well in his speech, fighting in a unified front. The release of the prisoners is the same. It's 345 Qassam and Hamas fighters. It's 229 Al-Aqsa brigades and Fatah fighters, 67 Saraya al-Quds fighters, 19 PFLP, Abu Ali Mustafa Brigades fighters, and six DFLP, National Resistance Brigades fighters. So those will be released. Part of the release is 296 people sentenced to life sentences, resistance fighters and leaders and cadre that were life sentences. And again, the breakdown is even. It's 127 Fatah, 123 Qassam Hamas, 36 Saraya al-Quds, and 17 DFLP and PFLP. So the unity that was shown on the battlefield throughout Al-Aqsa flood, throughout the 470 days, is represented in the prisoners that are being released. And these prisoner exchanges are critical to the resistance. We'll know that Yahya Sinwar was released in the last prisoner exchange. This is cadre that are in prisons that will be returning to the Palestinian National Movement. And that's something that even the Israeli Internal Security Services warned their Knesset about, that 82% of people returned to political activities. These are lifelong fighters for liberation, and they refused to sign, this is from Yahya Sinwar from the Shalit deal, refused to sign any kind of agreement that guarantees they will not go back to fighting. Sinwar refused to sign that, and after he refused to sign it, nobody in the Shalit deal signed it. And this deal, nobody is signing those guarantees that they will not return to political activism and to the fight for liberation. So those are important details that are in the first phase. And because this is the first phase, this is the humanitarian phase of the release. These are all people that could have been, the Israelis that are released, all could have been released on October the 8th. We know that. From Sinwar, we know that from the captives themselves who met Sinwar in the tunnels on October 7th and 8th. And Sinwar said that they would be returning in a day or two. Their guards told them they would be returning in a day or two, but Israel prioritized killing Palestinians and destroying the Gaza Strip over returning those prisoners. And because of that, the exchange deal is larger than it would have been at the time. In November, the exchange deal was 3-for-1. Now we're talking about 2,000 for 33. And that's just the first stage. The second stage of the deal is for the soldiers, the Israeli soldiers that are in captivity. There's more than 60 other people that will be held into the second stage of this deal. And the guarantees for those deals going from phase one to phase two are guaranteed by Egypt, Qatar, the U.S. And so the idea is that the first stage will turn over after 42 days into the second stage. And that's what we all hope continues. Of course, it's very difficult to trust the Israelis in any of these deals, which is something that is visible in this exchange as well, because there's 46 prisoners being released in this first round who were from the Shalit exchange in 2011, who were rearrested. With that kind of duplicity of the Israelis has been a core to this entire struggle. And of course, the edifice of lies that this whole struggle was built upon are part and parcel of the same thing. So Abu Bakr talked about still hearing drones. There's, according to the agreement, there's supposed to be only 10 hours. There's supposed to be 10 hours a day of no overflight, and on days when prisoners are exchanged, 12 hours of no overflight by drones, and the prisoners are to be exchanged at weekly intervals. Today, January 19th, and then another batch will be released on the 25th, then on February 3rd, February 9th, and throughout the 6 weeks in phases, and those Israelis will be returned in the same way they were returned today in central Gaza, and thousands of Palestinians will be returned to the Gaza Strip and to the West Bank as free citizens.
Of course, the Israelis have mandated that there be no expressions of joy for Palestinians receiving their loved ones from Israeli torture dungeons. I mean, even just today, Israeli police, I believe, were going to houses around Jerusalem, ordering families of Palestinian prisoners not to, you know, celebrate, not to hold, you know, receptions, no public expressions of joy.
Yeah, at their defeat, at Israel's defeat, at Israel's attempt to destroy the Gaza Strip and destroy the resistance, destroy the Palestinian people, failed. And now they want to hide those expressions of joy after what they've inflicted and the crimes that they've inflicted will, Abu Ubaida also said it, will follow them for the rest of their lives as people pursue justice against these criminals that we've watched for the last 470 days, even up till this morning.
That's right.
When they delayed the ceasefire and carried out more airstrikes, killing 30 people in just petty vengeance. And you juxtapose that with the dignity of the Palestinian people in Gaza who have lost everything. And are out in the streets. And I think we have footage of that. We have footage of the civil defense that were not defeated. You know, the teachers, we know from Dunya, the teachers were not defeated. You know, here's the civil defense. And these people are the best people that the world has. These people dedicated their entire lives without any resources over these last 470 days, without people had no ability to phone them, to call them from the rubble. And these are the men digging with their hands because Israel bombed the civil defense heavy machinery so that they couldn't use it. And there's the paramedics who are also the finest among us, and the respect that they have in the Gaza Strip is unparalleled.
John, you mentioned two things that I want to say, to talk a little bit more about. One is Abu Ubaida's speech, which I want to get to in a minute, just some of the key points that he made. But the other is the release of the Israeli captives in Saraya Square in the heart of Gaza City. And I think we have some footage of that that we can talk about. And this was incredibly symbolic, because what we see in this footage is the Nukba fighters, these are the elite fighters of the Qassam Brigades, coming out into the streets in their uniforms, looking battle ready, just as they did on or before October 7th. They came, those are the Red Cross vehicles, but the Qassam fighters showed up in what looked like brand new pickup trucks, which is pretty incredible. And they were being greeted by their people. They were being greeted as heroes. There were scenes of people taking selfies with them, kissing them on their heads, just tremendous support and joy, which just shatters the idea that the resistance is somehow isolated by the people or hated by the people. And there they are signing the certificate, handing over the Israeli captives and showing it. But the symbolism of this is important, because at a certain point early in the war, as you showed us, John, the Israelis actually showed up and occupied Saraya Square. And back in November 2023, we had the prisoner releases during that 1 week truce, which Hamas also did in Saraya Square. And so the symbolism of showing how they are still in control of Gaza City, even when the Israelis were there, they were there. They were there underground. They were there watching, as you showed us. There were cameras everywhere. Their eyes were everywhere. And I think those images, when Israelis see them, and we saw also images of Israelis watching on big screens in Tel Aviv and different locations in the streets and restaurants, they saw all this. And they, so this was palpable, demonstrable proof to the Israeli public of the utter failure of their army, and the fact that the total victory they were promised was not achieved. Along with, as we mentioned before, the fact that the police, I'm talking about the civil police here, coming out on the streets, directing traffic, the municipality beginning to restore services, and so on. So that's the day after. The day after, Hamas is Hamas.
Yeah, and hours, at minutes, right? It was minutes. There wasn't a few days to gather themselves. And just let me say, Ali, for the censors, that video that we showed that has no prisoners, no captives in that video, the video's been edited so that there's none of that. That's just crowd scenes. So for the YouTube censors that are listening, that has been removed from that. But yeah, it that footage is the footage from the first minutes. And when you said it about Gaza City, downtown Gaza City, it was exactly the same in Beit Hanun, right? The Israelis went into Beit Hanun 2 weeks ago. They thought that they had destroyed Beit Hanun and no one was there. And they took more casualties in that week than they had in any week in months previous. So they were able to fight right till the last moment with the same vigor as on the first day. And that I don't think you could script a defeat more articulately than showing those the footage of the way that those fighters come out in the streets. And this is just a fraction of them. At some point when the situation really does calm down, there will be a major parade, a proper parade in Gaza that will fete these fighters as the heroes of their society, no matter what political party anybody is with. This is a united national liberation struggle that is being represented here.
And that's something that you predicted very early on, of course, in this Holocaust, that no matter what Israel and the United States were going to throw at the Palestinians, that the resistance was not going to be defeated and there would be an enormous victory parade in the streets of Gaza after.
I mean, I think that there's an advantage that I had of having been there and lived there and experienced it. And of course, no battle was anything like this one. And there was no experience. Nobody had experience for what happened this time. But the spirit of the Palestinians in the most catastrophic circumstances, I saw it and I knew that would remain, and that these fighters themselves were prepared, and we charted it every single week for the entire war, the preparation for the operation itself on October 7th, but the preparation for the battle is just remarkable. And another thing that Abu Ubaida said, he said that we, just as we fought together, we will rebuild together. And he said that we will rebuild with the same vigor as we fought. And it's just a remarkable thing that he said. He said, your wound is our wound to the Palestinians. He said, your pain is our pain. Your hopes are our hopes, and we will rebuild together everything that the enemy destroyed, and to treat the reconstruction in the same way that they treated the battle, to be in the same trench. And we watched that, day in and day out for 470 days. They fought in the same trench as their people, and the fighters are heroes. The children are heroes. The children were the first ones in the streets, faster than the police, faster than the civil defense. It's always the kids. And shout out to the kids for living through this. And what Abu Bakr said is exactly right. This is an entire generation of children who have seen that they can win, that the entire world can be aimed at this tiny little besieged enclave and can't defeat it. That is going to have reverberations through the future for however long it lasts of the Israeli state, because this is a remarkable moment. And hiding pictures of people celebrating or threatening families having gatherings, none of that makes any difference to the way that this has is going to be absorbed by the people that lived through it. They lived through the worst, and they came out on the other end surviving, unified. It's just remarkable. It's been an overwhelming day. I didn't sleep. It's been remarkable to watch.
It truly is. And just on this, Nora had mentioned a point, of course, about Israel trying to ban celebrations in the West Bank. But what's striking me is how much Hamas and the Qassam Brigades are in control of the narrative here, because they did that prisoner release in Saraya Square. And then Abu Ubaida gave his address by video. So it was coordinated. And that was pretty remarkable, and it was announced, so everyone was waiting to watch it. He spoke for 23 minutes. He appeared in his neatly pressed uniform and his, with the keffiyeh wrapped around his face as usual. And his appearance is remarkable. I think the last time he had appeared was on October 7th, so it's been like 3 months. And he'd appeared something like 30 times throughout this war. And John already mentioned some of the key points in his speech, but there were others that I think are just worth highlighting very briefly, which is that he was very specific about the ceasefire. He said some things that I think are very important. He said that this particular agreement would have been possible a year ago, that they were ready to do this agreement a year ago. And that confirms what everyone else is saying. But he says Israel did not want to do it. Instead, Netanyahu and his fascist government insisted on the genocide aimed at expelling our people and causing as much destruction as possible. And he also affirmed their commitment to it, Hamas's commitment, not just Hamas. He spoke on behalf of all the resistance factions. He said, "We affirm our commitment to the ceasefire and our readiness to implement its provisions and conditions in order to stop the fighting." And he said that they were committed to the schedule of prisoner releases and to protect the enemy's prisoners until they're handed over in exchange for our people. But he said that all of this depends on Israel's commitment to the deal, and that any violations by the enemy could endanger either Hamas's ability to carry out the terms of the deal or would endanger the safety of the prisoners. So that was important because they're setting out here that we are not the ones who are going to spoil this. We're committed to this. We're committed to making it work. And I think the other point that is worth noting is really his acknowledgement of the support that they, that the resistance received from the region around the world. And he mentioned in this order Ansarullah and the people of Yemen, who of course have done the maritime blockade and been firing the Palestine 2 missiles and the drones from Yemen. Then he mentioned the resistance and the people in Lebanon and their sacrifices, both from their leadership, their soldiers, and their people. Then he mentioned the Islamic Republic of Iran for its continuous support for the resistance and the True Promise operations. He mentioned the Iraqi resistance, and he mentioned the Free People of Jordan and their fighters who crossed the border and aimed their weapons in the right direction. I'm paraphrasing what he said. And then a broader thanks to all the Arab and Muslim people of the world. And he said that Qassam had received millions of messages from around the region, from as far away as Morocco and Indonesia, offering to come to Gaza and fight with the resistance. And then he mentioned all the free peoples of the world who demonstrated in their millions and who continue to do so in rejection of the Zionist genocide and in solidarity with the Palestinian people. So it was really a comprehensive address that addressed multiple audiences. First and foremost, the Palestinian people and the people of Gaza, making the points that John had mentioned, but also this broader global audience. And I think a key takeaway from the events of today is that maybe before October 7th, Israel and its American and European backers thought there was an option to destroy Hamas that they had and that they were holding in their pockets. Now it's clear they don't have that option. Israel did everything to Gaza except use nuclear weapons, and it is very clear they cannot dislodge this resistance. And it appears to be entirely intact, even despite Israel's destruction of Gaza. So the symbolism and the messages today are absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah, and he also said that they dismantled the myth of the Israeli military. Not only did Qassam survive the battle, but Israel didn't. Israel was the one who got taken apart on October 7th, proved that it couldn't defend its own population, that required an air bridge that he referred to of weapons shipments from the United States. This was a joint United States-Israeli war with Western backing, diplomatic backing, financial backing. And so it's remarkable. And he also pointed out to the fighters and said that they fought with ingenuity, which is something that we've covered for all these 470 days. And he said that this is an epic battle that will be studied in war colleges for generations to come. And they're not going to be studying Israel's tactics. They're going to be studying the Palestinian resistance.
They may be studying them as what not to do.
Exactly. To do. Yeah.
And
he
did.
Fails. Yeah.
Yeah. And he did also talk about the broader damage to Israel. He talked about the military damage that he said thousands of Israeli soldiers killed and injured, 2,000 Israeli armored vehicles or armored units destroyed or put out of action. But he also talked about the economic damage, the loss of morale, the political damage, the fact that Israeli leaders and soldiers are now pursued around the world as war criminals. So it also shows a sophisticated understanding of the political and global context and a deep reading of the situation, which you don't see from the Israelis. The Israelis live in their fantasies. They're not making reality-based assessments, which is why I think they failed so badly, because they went in with hubris, with overconfidence, with a sense that we are the greatest army in the region, if not the world. We have the backing of the United States and the world behind us. And that hubris did not serve them well, did not serve them at all, really. So it's the implications of what has happened are profound. And although we knew because of the analysis that we were seeing every week from John, from the videos coming out, and from what people in Gaza were telling us, that the resistance was still fighting, but seeing it is believing it. Seeing is believing. And what we saw today was the confirmation of all of that. And that's why Israeli analysts of all kinds and Israeli ministers and former ministers, the Israeli press has been full today of Israeli big shots saying we've suffered a major strategic defeat. And so one of the fears, I mean, this is sort of maybe another topic. Maybe we want to pause and look at some of the other footage coming out of Gaza. But I want to get into the durability, what we think about the durability of this agreement, because I know that's something a lot of people are concerned about. But yeah. I don't know, Nora, Asa, John, you want to jump in on this?
Well, I wanted to get John's thoughts on the vehicles, the military vehicles that Israel left behind after they were completely destroyed or at least disabled by Palestinian resistance. I know we have a short reel of Palestinians coming back to the north and happening upon these vehicles in the field. Tell us about the significance of this, what we're seeing.
So this is these are shots. They're going to find these all over when people return. These are the M113s. These are troop carriers, armored troop carriers from the previous generation. These are like Vietnam era. What the Israelis did was brought them back to life by making them robotic, unmanned vehicles, and they would fill them up with explosives. And they would drive them and explode them and use them as car bombs. That's how failed they were as a military structure. And this there, that's a D9. That's a Caterpillar. You can put that on the BDS brochure. That's a Caterpillar D9 bulldozer. But you can see there, that's one of those M113s that they blew up. They used them as remotely operated car bombs.
Around Kamal Adwan.
Around the hospitals. Hospital. Yeah. And so that these kind of things will be left when there are other vehicles, when they're more, when their tanks were disabled, we saw the footage of them dragging their tanks. They didn't want to leave any trophies behind. They've left these M113s because they were essentially used as disposable items. But when you really think about what you're looking at, that this army that's funded and backed by the richest countries in the world is using these vehicles remotely because they don't have the courage to fight in the territory that they're trying to get back the image that the Qassam brigades took away from them on October 7th. And the way that they can think to do it is to commit a genocide against largely against children, that their military targets are hospitals, and that they leave behind these essentially tank bombs that they've made to blow up neighborhoods. This is a record that will be a stain on Israel and a stain on the United States that can never be forgotten. It's shocking. And the, you know, the happiness of people seeing these, I worry about some of these. I think they need to be careful around these. Like, some of these are essentially unexploded weapons being used to blow up civilian neighborhoods. So if you're listening, be careful of those before you go poking around on them. Those ones looked like they had been emptied out because the Israelis would use them for other things as well that were demented. Like, they would take anti-tank mines and fill up those M113s with anti-tank mines and robotically drive them so that they could take the anti-tank mines to their fighters so that they could rig up buildings to destroy buildings more cheaply than through airstrikes. So the ingenuity that the Israelis used were for how to destroy children's homes. While the Palestinian resistance built an indigenous army that fought for 470 days. And we don't know the toll was significant for everybody. Everybody paid a significant price for this battle. But where this takes the Palestinian national movement going forward, this is the kind of thing that you can never take away. These kind of images and feelings of victory and undefeated, you know, that you were not defeated through this entire time. That was one of Israel's goals. Israel's war goals were to return the captives through violence. That failed. Destroy Qassam. That failed. Destroy the Hamas government. That failed. Number four was that Gaza would no longer be a threat to Israel. And Abu Bakr spoke to that. That is the biggest fail of all of their goals, because Gaza is a threat to Israel going forward. And the spirit of resistance that this genocide has created is absolutely a threat that hiding people... Well, Abu Bakr said it too about people's feelings of of anger and vengeance and loss that but Abu Bakr and Abu Ubaida spoke about it, and we're going to hear a lot of people speak about it. You know, we saw it from the children themselves. You know, some of those really you know, the epic scenes where the kids coming out of a bombed out building and surviving and saying, you know, we're still here. You know, I think about the one of the old man sitting on his chair saying that the entire world is trying to fight this one tiny little spot on the map and they can't defeat us. Those kind of things, that fuels a liberation movement, you know, as much as any weapon or any other thing. That spirit of resistance is strong from this battle.
And speaking of Abu Ubaida, he addressed a message. We didn't mention this, but I think it's also worth noting, to the resistance in the West Bank, encouraging them, and specifically to Jenin. So, you know, this is a massive inspiration for other Palestinians, and an example that you know, governments in the region will be afraid of, that are either colluding with Israel or in the pockets of the United States and so on. But yeah, it's pretty remarkable to see those armored vehicles, and I'm sure we've only seen a fraction. And that armor plating, that, you know, all that gear presumably will go into the Qassam recycling program.
Absolutely, it will. I mean, they in order to prepare for this battle, they sent scuba divers down to World War One sunken British ships to get the shells off the ships. So all of this will be used, at all these munitions, the 70,000 tons of bombs that were dropped on the Gaza Strip are going to be, first, they're going to be taken out of people's homes. People, the resistance themselves will tell people where the booby traps are, to protect them, and they will remove the unexploded ordnance as part of their role as a government, and then they will use them for the resistance. And so there's just layer upon layer of failure to this, and the toll was enormous, but the spirit of liberation that comes out of it is something that you just can't put back in the bottle.
Well, there was one goal of some Israelis, such as the right-wing ministers, who now seem to, or at least one of them now seems to have left the cabinet, that they had, which was to actually recolonize Gaza, to add new settlements in the Gaza Strip, return the settlements to the Gaza Strip, and that has not only failed spectacularly, but it didn't get anywhere. And also, remember that the Gaza envelope settlements have not returned. Like, this is something I'm sort of banging on about people to remember, that the settlements that were assaulted on the 7th of October, those populations have still not returned. So in a way, it's not quite a return of territory, but it's certainly a retreat of Israeli settlers.
And of course, will they return after seeing the Qassam fighters marching through Gaza, looking disciplined and ready to go into battle?
You can't picture it. You can't picture it.
Oh, there's a lot of big question marks that the state of Israel faces on this day.
Yeah, there's a feeling, you know, there was really a feeling that a lot of us had on the 7th of October 2023, which was that the map had changed. The map had literally changed. And to me, that change is still intact. It just seems like we're seeing a real historic shift, which I don't think people are really adjusting to the reality of. And we're starting to see that play out now really before us.
Yeah. Well, we should talk a little bit about what comes next, because a lot of people, you know, are understandably very apprehensive about how durable this agreement is. The first hours were chaotic and fragile. It didn't go into effect at 8:30 local time as people expected, although the people of Gaza weren't going to let continued Israeli bombing spoil their ceasefire. They started celebrating immediately and going home while Israel was still bombing. But in any case, I wanted to, you know, the question is, as we discussed in the last live stream on Thursday, the resistance was fundamental to forcing Israel to accept its terms, the same terms that the resistance offered a year ago. But also there was the Trump factor. Donald Trump or his envoy came in and put direct pressure on Israel that the Biden administration had absolutely refused to do. Now, there have been, coming from the Netanyahu camp, this notion, Netanyahu said, or he's trying to spin the agreement, the fact that the first phase has been agreed, but the second phase still has to be negotiated. He's trying to spin it to say that Trump has promised that he will support Israel to go back to war. So Netanyahu is trying to market this as, oh, we're just committed to the first phase and then we can resume the war. And a lot of people are afraid that that's what will happen. And so I want to talk about that because obviously we don't know what will happen. Anything can happen with Israel. It's an utterly depraved, lawless entity that it has no limits or red lines and no and does not respect agreements. That said, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that if I had to bet, I would bet that the ceasefire will hold for a couple of reasons. One is that the Israeli army is broken and demoralized. That's a material reality. We talked about that in the last program, reservists not showing up, probably tens of thousands of serious injuries. The full numbers are not known. So they're not ready to go back to war. Thousands of armored vehicles destroyed and so on. What would they do that they haven't already tried? It's not like they have a plan to defeat the resistance. If they did, why didn't they do it? So what are they going to go back and do? More of the same. I think that the internal political dynamics in Israel are now going to start to move against a return to the war because people are going to start counting the cost and they're going to start coming to terms with the scale of the failure on October 7th and on every single day since October 7th. And as of recently, the polls in Israel, remember, up until very recently, the polls were saying that the Israelis supported the genocide fully and that they supported only a temporary deal to get the hostages out and then go back to the war. Now the polls are saying that a majority just want an end to the war. They want a deal that will end the war. And that's also explicable by the fact that the economy is a disaster. We talked about that with Shir Hever last week on Thursday about divestment, about brain drain, about Israel's sinking credit rating, the fact that this war has cost billions of dollars, and it's not a given anymore that the U.S. Congress is just going to vote for 10 billion, 20 billion, 30 billion package after package for Israel. And I think also the international dynamics are against this. I think that, you know, Israel had a lot of support from the West on the basis that they could pull this off. Go in, take the gloves off, destroy Hamas once and for all, solve this problem for us. And Israel utterly failed. So are they going to back Israel to do that a second time? I'm not so sure. Some of them might. Keir Starmer probably would. He seems to be just like an utterly unhinged fanatic. But the question is, would Donald Trump?
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, as we always said, Trump is a wild card. He's not ideologically tied one way or the other when it comes to Israel. He is tied to money. He's tied to his own reputation. He's tied to capital. You know, the Biden administration was ideologically committed to this Holocaust, to this genocide, to ramping up violence against children in Palestine. And it remains to be seen what comes next. Israel, I don't see how it can recover from this reputationally, militarily, economically. We're going to be watching it very closely. We're going to be watching the next steps.
And there is just... I think worth pointing out this really fascinating story that published by NBC with comments from an official, they're saying an official of the Trump transition team, which I found really fascinating. I think worth taking note of. And the headline, we can show it, is Trump's Middle East envoy is considering a visit to the Gaza Strip amid ceasefire deal. And they're talking about Steve Witkoff, who is the one who went and arm twisted and demanded that Netanyahu come down to his office on Shabbat and then told him you're going to sign the deal. And Netanyahu signed the deal. And it says that Witkoff is considering a visit to the war-torn Gaza Strip as part of his efforts to keep a ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas on track, according to a transition official with direct knowledge of the ceasefire process. And it says that underscoring just how fragile the president-elect's team believes the ceasefire deal that's set to go into effect on Sunday is, Witkoff also plans to be a near constant presence in the region over the coming weeks and months to troubleshoot flare-ups on the ground that he believes could unravel the agreement. So the next weeks and months. So that suggests that they do have a long-term commitment to the agreement. And then it says, there's a quote from this official, you have to be right on top of it, ready to snuff out a problem if it happens, the official said. And then this is really interesting because they say they're worried about some incident that could spark, you know, an unraveling of the deal. And here, this fascinating quote from this transition official, remember, there's a lot of people, radicals, fanatics, not just from the Hamas side, from the right wing of the Israeli side, who are absolutely incentivized to blow this whole deal up, the transition official said. So that's fascinating. It sounds like the Trump team knows that it is Israel that is just as likely, if not the most likely, to try to break up this deal. And they're signaling, we know that. We know what your game is. And then it says that the official says, if we don't help the Gazans, if we don't make their life better, if we don't give them a sense of hope, there's going to be a rebellion, the transition official said. I mean, that suggests some understanding that you can't just constantly beat people down and demonize them as terrorists and as subhumans and hope for any different result. So that's, again, interesting, possibly hopeful, but there is this rather worrying next paragraph, which I think should raise a lot of eyebrows. It says, the question of how to rebuild Gaza remains, as well as where some 2 million Palestinians can be relocated in the meantime. Indonesia, for instance, is among the locations under discussion for where some of them could go, the transition official said. Even the question of whether Gazans would be willing to relocate is up in the air. Well, obviously, Gazans are not willing to relocate. And that's just, you know, absolutely bizarre. But maybe, you know, if Witkoff goes to Gaza and sees the reality, they will come up with a more reality-based approach to the reconstruction. Nonetheless, obviously, take everything with a pinch of salt, but I thought this article was interesting for showing that this wasn't, at least the Trump team is signaling, this wasn't just about getting day one photo op of hostages being released and Trump getting a big win, that there does seem to be some level of long-term commitment to making this agreement work. And given that Trump was ready to pressure Israel to sign it in the first place, that suggests to me that they may well be willing to pressure Israel to adhere to it. And Israel at this point, presumably, I mean, John might know better than me, you know, when you do a genocide for 15 months and when you go to war against Hezbollah and lose, you need to replace your arsenal. When you've lost 2,000 armored vehicles, you need to replace them, and that's very expensive. And I don't know what stage they are in terms of being able to replace all that stuff. And they're totally dependent on the United States. So there is leverage there that it seems to me Trump is more likely to use than Biden has been. Again, maybe I'm being too optimistic, but there are signals here that suggest that we can't necessarily take for granted what's going to happen one way or the other. And I just wanted to point that out.
And it's important to note too that Qassam holds the Israeli soldiers. So there's the next phase, if Israel is going to abandon their soldiers, there's a significant cost for that too that isn't measured in, you know, dollars and cents or armored vehicles. These are very consequential decisions that Israel's facing right now. And like we said, there's a lot of question marks throughout their society. Shir talked about it on the show last week as well. There's a lot of questions to be answered that are very unclear for the Israelis. And one of the ways that this deal is written is that the phase one can be extended. The negotiations for phase two begin on, I think, day 22. And if there's not an agreement, that the phase one, the ceasefire component, can extend. And I think that's where the U.S. pressure will be applied to that period, I think. And so even if we don't have a lot of faith in the Americans after, you know, their entire imperial history, it might be possible to see an extension of that period. It's just,
go ahead.
Those quotes from this anonymous administration official, apart from this strange one about Indonesia, they really remind me what Trump said. You know, he said this quote that made headlines about if there wasn't a ceasefire deal or a hostage deal, as he called it, before his inauguration, there would be hell to pay. And everyone took that as him threatening Hamas, which, you know, I think it probably was. But then he also said it again and said, it won't be good for the Palestinians. It won't be good for anyone, frankly. And that was really just an open diplomatic threat to Israel. Whether he'll carry through on that is another thing. But I can't think of a precedent of that, to be honest, really.
Yeah. And I just can't, you know, there's a very easy and durable, you know, solution for, you know, where to put 2 million Palestinians in Gaza while Gaza is being reconstructed. It's about 20 kilometers away, right? People from their ancestral homelands who have been waiting for 76 years to return as equal citizens, as indigenous people of that historic land of Palestine. It would be very easy. People would be very thrilled. You know, Abu Bakr was talking about his ancestral village, which is very, very close to the Gaza Strip. And, you know, that is the ultimate goal. That's the goal that Israel doesn't want anyone to think about. But that is the inevitable solution. That is the inevitability of this entire 80-year colonial project. It is going, you know, just as you said, the resistance fighters are going to have a victory parade after this is over. The people will return to their villages hopefully in our lifetimes and in theirs.
Maybe, they should be rehoused in Kfar Azza. And
Kibbutz, yeah, that's where...
empty anyway.
That's right. That's right.
And that's important because obviously we're focusing on Gaza, but Gaza is part of Palestine, and the focus can't just be on Gaza as if the solution is entirely within Gaza.
Yeah.
The momentum has to be kept towards the liberation of Palestine, not necessarily, you know, through whatever means can be available. So if there are political means to end this genocidal regime, the way the South African apartheid regime was ended through negotiations, everyone would prefer that. Yeah. What we've seen is what October 7th proved is the impossibility of ending the Palestinian resistance. And I really think that's not an exaggeration, because the Israelis had this idea that one day we may have to go into Gaza. It will be very difficult and very bloody, but we will topple the Hamas regime. The idea was it would be costly, but there's no doubt we can do it.
He said for future generations, if you remember, he said we're going to erase Hamas and the idea of them for future generations. And that is a spectacular fail, because this movement, this liberation movement, is going to go down in history. You couldn't have done a worse job of attaining that goal, because it's remarkable. It's remarkable. Yeah,
people like winners, and across the region, the scenes today, the scenes that were seen on Al Jazeera, watched by tens of millions of people on other channels, were the scenes of winners, of people feeling that they've won. It's not us saying to people in Gaza, "You won," and people in Gaza saying, "Oh, look at our misery. How could you say this is a victory?" No, it's people in Gaza saying, We won, not won in the sense that we overthrew Israel and ended Israel and returned to our homes, but we survived and prevailed over the empire, over the arsenal of the United States, airlifted 24/7, and that's not a small thing. That is not a small thing, because Israel was not fighting alone. It was fighting with the United States, with Britain, with Keir Starmer's Labour Party spy planes flying over Gaza, collecting intelligence for Israel, with the Democratic Party aircraft carriers trying to fend off the missiles from the Houthis or whatever. I'm saying that facetiously, but these are supposedly the progressive parties in these societies that were fully committed to this genocide, and yet they could not defeat tiny Gaza. They couldn't defeat Yemen. They haven't defeated Hezbollah. They haven't defeated Iran. There is a lot of hubris about that, and I think that that's another factor here that militates against any quick resumption of the war in the form we saw it, which is that Iran held off from True Promise 3, probably because they saw the way this was going and they wanted the ceasefire to take place. Iran has always said, that's our priority. That's our priority. But if the war goes back, and Israel starts bombing Gaza again and massacring, carrying out massacres of 70, 80, 100 people a day, I think there's a very high chance that Iran will unleash 1,000 missiles. I think that's very likely to happen. And people have underestimated them in the past, but I don't think it was a coincidence that just a few days ago, they released this video of one of their underground missile cities that had never been seen before. There was a message in that to say, don't think we've forgotten about you. And I think also, week after week of Israelis coming home, when the only thing Israelis have seen for 15 months is reports of Israelis being killed in Gaza, week after week of Israelis coming home and being joyously reunited with their families is going to make it very difficult for Israel to say, well, we're going to condemn the rest of them to death now and start bombing Gaza. So, yeah,
especially, if it all holds and week by week, there's more and more of them being released, which Israeli leader is going to be able to just overtopple all that, to stop that from happening?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's hard to say. It's hard to make any definitive predictions, like you said, but it's really hard. It's really hard to me. It's really hard to see them going back to this this genocide in this form, at least.
Well, we I think we about covered it for today. I know we're all exhausted. We're our hearts are full, our minds are going 10 million miles an hour, and I think I am just you know, waiting to see what happens next. I know that the next 6 days especially will be very critical. We are going to come back on Thursday because we have our regular live stream now on Thursday, usual time. And we're going to keep
covering
this.
Very, very interesting guest.
Yes. Yeah, I know. I'm trying not to give it away, but it's going to be great. Yeah, just please continue to go to the Electronic Intifada, our website. We have some incredible new features by our writers in Gaza. There's, you know, our friend Sam Husseini being dragged away by cops at the U.S. State Department press briefing a few days ago. Check it out. All of our coverage is there. Sign up for our email list, subscribe to our YouTube channel, donate if you can and have the means, and we'll see you on Thursday. And thank you, as always, to Tamara Nassar. We revoke your red card, of course. Thank you for the direction and production at this last minute for this live stream. And on behalf of myself, Ali, John, and Asa, thank you, everyone, and we'll see you Thursday.